Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, a woman who says she was raped by a missionary training center president sues the Mormon Church. The state of Utah requests control of a sizable chunk of unclaimed water in Bear Lake, prompting worries about how the Great Salt Lake will be affected, and how Salt Lake City's priorities for an inland port were pushed aside. Joining me to talk about these stories, Salt Lake Tribune managing editor David Noyce. Welcome, David. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Also, government reporter Bill Denzer, a first-time appearance on the show. Good morning to you, Bill.
Good morning.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod is here. Hi, Emma. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And columnist Michelle Quist joins us as well. Hello, Michelle, and good morning.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Listeners, you are invited to weigh in on the stories we are covering today. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us up. We are at 801-355-8255. David Noyce, managing editor, we've been following the story of a woman who is kind of at the center of a controversy involving the Mormon Church's missionary training center. This is something that came to light a few weeks back because of leaked audio of a recording that this woman made where she is confronting a former president of the MTC who she accuses of raping her when she was at the center in the 1980s. A couple of developments in this story this week. The latest is that we learned who the woman making this allegation is. So tell us her story. She held a news conference just yesterday. Why did she hold a news conference, David?
She says because she's ready to confront publicly what happened to her in sort of a Mormon Me Too moment. Her name is McKenna Denson. She lives in Colorado. Of course, media have been talking to her for weeks, but now she has publicly come out to confront the church and to get an admission of wrongdoing. To seek justice and also to change church policies in dealing with these kinds of issues. And she gave a very impressive news conference.
And on Wednesday, she announced that she was filing a lawsuit against the church. This was before we publicly knew who she was, I think, if that's correct.
Correct. Although they did release a news release that day that had her name, so we were able to publish her name that day.
What is she saying in the suit, and what is she – I mean, as you said that she's trying to change policies, but, I mean, is there a sort of financial aspect of this? What is she trying to do with the lawsuit?
Well, she is seeking unspecified damages, which we assume would mean some kind of cash or financial payback, I guess, pay, and also seeking policy changes into how the church allows or allows members a way to report abuse, to make sure that abuse is reported to authorities. And to
when you say authorities, you mean outside authority, police?
Exactly. To police. It's a policy change she's taking. She's not the only one seeking those kinds of changes in that sense. Also, because we have the Protect the Children, which had a march, of course, about a week and a half ago, I guess, just before General Conference, at which tens of thousands of people signed a petition seeking some changes in Bishop's interviews process, and also in questions that are asked during those interviews.
And essentially, that's some of those policies include who is present at those interviews.
Correct.
Again, the allegation that Denson is making against Bishop is that he raped her. He denies that. And an interesting part of this story is something that the Tribune reported this week. A Mormon church lawyer, or a lawyer hired by the church, I should say, compiled a dossier of damaging information on Denson. And that leaked, and there are people who are saying that this looks like an attempt to try to intimidate a potential victim into silence. What is this dossier about, David?
David Jordan, a local attorney, very respected attorney in town, was hired by the LDS Church to investigate her allegations. They did a very extensive investigation, and nine pages we've obtained nine pages, and I believe that was the whole letter that was sent to Denson's attorney. At the time, they had been seeking some kind of settlement from the church. They used this ammunition, I guess, that they gathered about her background. They got into lots of things about her past. They got into relationships that she had, her lost jobs, her criminal record. She acknowledged that she had a criminal record. lots of things that people are seeing as a way to, obviously, to scare off her, but also it could have the consequence, maybe whether it's intended or not, of scaring off any other potential victims.
Denson also gave a child up for adoption when she was a teenager. That was part of this dossier. I want to come up with a better word than dossier, mm-hmm. but that's a
file letter, file whatever. Yeah. It was an investigative papers.
And it named this woman who's now an adult, who was Denson's biological child.
Correct. She reconnected with her birth mother, with Denson. It was a closed adoption. Interestingly, the adoption was done through LDS, what would today be Family Services. Now, they no longer do adoptions. That was discontinued a few years ago. But at that point, it was done that way. But she was able, through some investigative sleuthing of her own, this daughter who was adopted, to reconnect with her birth mother. She doesn't really have a close relationship with her birth mother, but she did reconnect with her. She was very upset that her name was included in this report.
Sure.
Not only that, not that just her adoption was in there, and that she'd had this child, but that her name was there. And this letter was shared with Denson's attorney that had her name in there. We do not know. No one's exactly sure how this got out widely that had her name. Now, Greg Bishop, who is the son of the MTC president who was accused, mm-hmm. Got a copy of that letter that was shared. And he did not, however, include the name of the daughter, daughter who was adopted.
But he did send it on to members of the press as a way of saying,
he's working to use to protect his father, I suppose, is the main reason, who's also sort of acting as his attorney, at least at this point.
Okay. I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or at sltrib.com. Michelle Quist, Tribune columnist, there are a couple of aspects of this that I'd like to address, including some statements that came out of LDS conference this past weekend, but we'll get to that a little bit later. How do you view all of this? Here's a woman who says that she had a horrific experience at the Missionary Training Center. She confronted her alleged attacker, and this has sparked a lot of conversation within the church. Give me your take.
Well, she confronted her accuser, and she's been telling authorities for the past 30 years of what happened to her, hoping that somebody would recognize that, hoping that somebody would, grant some accountability for him, and it just hasn't happened to her. The hard thing here is that members are facing the fact that the church is also a corporation. And, these things that, they're developing or compiling this dossier and offering financial settlements and trying to do what they did before the case was actually filed to limit the
potential damages to themselves. Sure.
Yeah. The disaster that this has become is a result of them being, a corporation. And it's hard for members to realize that because, and appropriately, members expect more. We expect more from a church. We know that it's common, especially in this Me Too movement, to victimize the victims. We don't want to see our church do that. That's exactly opposite of what we should be doing. We should be reaching out to her, listening to her, believing her, and helping her heal. The ironic thing is that she has done exactly the right things that they are blaming her for. They publicized the name of her daughter that was adopted. She did the right thing. She got pregnant and gave the daughter up, gave the baby up for adoption when she couldn't care for him. Her. That's exactly what she should have done. She left her mission early, and the church has said she was on a mission for a brief time. They used brief time as if that somehow guilted her into not being a good member. She just had this horrific experience in the MTC. She should have left her mission early, because she needed time to heal from that, not to be out proselyting of a church that she just was abused by.
David, how has the church responded in the wake of, say, the press conference, but also in the wake of all of this becoming a public discussion?
Well, interesting what Michelle says, too, because the church's statement surrounding the lawsuit and just prior to the lawsuit tried to make that point. Look, we've hired an attorney, because we have a responsibility to investigate these allegations, but we're also a church and we care for all of our members. Now, it's really hard publicly to come across as if that's what you're really doing because you can't separate the two, for one thing. Also, we've heard nothing from the LDS Church about if they're investigating, if there's other potential victims from if these allegations are true in their totality, that there could possibly be other victims at the MTC during that time or in other places. We've heard nothing from the church about whether they're doing that, which is, I think, a concern for many members within the church and obviously those from without also.
And in the leaked recording that Denson had going out, she does reference the idea of there being other potential victims, people that she had spoken to, or at least one person she had spoken to.
She does.
And Bishop admitted having a frisky back rub with another missionary.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, I want to turn to the LDS. David, do you have something to add? I can see it in your face.
I just lost my train of thought. Go ahead and ask the question, Roger.
Well, I wanted to turn to the LDS conference and something that relates to this story. There's more to talk about from conference. But first, an LDS apostle said something that drew flack, and it was in the context of the conversation about sexual harassment, sexual assault that has been happening here and around the country and around the world because of the Me Too movement. David Noyce, explain the story here. Some comments that didn't land well.
No.
What were they?
Quentin Cook, who is an apostle, fairly senior in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, was the next to last speaker in conference. Now, this was not what his main thrust of his talk was about. It was talk about temples and being ready to meet God, things like that. But he had this reference to non-consensual immorality. He referred to that. And the interesting thing in the footnotes of his talk that have been published online, it refers to the Me Too movement. It uses that word. He never does use the word Me Too movement during his sermon. And that does not land well because, as many people have pointed out, and we pointed out in our initial story on it, because we saw the reaction it was getting, that we're talking about rape here. Now, certainly the victim is not guilty of any kind of immorality, of course, and that is what the church's policy is. The church's policy, and its stated policy that was reinforced recently when they announced some other changes to their policies, that victims of sexual abuse are not guilty of any kind of immorality and have no need of repentance. There's no sin involved. So it was an odd choice of words that Quentin Cook used.
And he used it, I mean, in direct juxtaposition with the term consensual immorality, saying that we must also oppose consensual, you know, immorality, which is also a sin. The idea being that, yeah, as you've said, that you know, being the victim of rape is equivalent to engaging in immoral activity.
I mean, I think that's how people took it. Now, I think most people that we've interviewed don't think that was his intent, but that is the way. But when he makes that juxtaposition, and maybe that was what he was going for, to try to make that kind of contrast, because we assume he's talking then about people who are having sex outside of marriage, whether it's a same-sex relationship or an opposite-sex relationship, whatever. We assume that's what he's referring to. I've been checking every day to see if the wording's going to change, because that's happened before. In 2010, Boyd K. Packer gave a talk in which he was that time the senior apostle in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, in which he seemed to counter what church's stance was at the time on gay Mormons, trying to suggest that gay Mormons, first of all, were not born with that sexual orientation, and that they could change. Now, that may have been the church's policy decades ago, but it was not the church's policy at the time. Elder Packer President Packer at that time took a lot of heat for that, eventually changed the talk when it was actually published. I check every day to see if it's changed yet. It hadn't yet as of this morning.
You know, Michelle Quist, before we turn to other parts of conference, can we just talk about these comments for a section?
Yeah.
Consensual immorality, non-consensual immorality.
Yeah. There were a few problems with it. The first was that he switched so quickly to consensual immorality. And it seemed to, because he did that, equate the perpetrator of a rape with somebody who's having sex outside of marriage. You know, and for somebody to hear that, you know, because we weren't talking about the victim when he talked about consensual, non-consensual immorality. He was talking about the perpetrator. Mm. So then he went from that sin to the next sin as if, you know, we need to do all of these together. Me Too is in a footnote. right now. Right now, it's the conversation. And we wanted to hear more of, it's not okay to do this. It's not okay to take advantage of your authority. It's not okay to abuse people within your, you know, within the system, number one. And number two, for those victims, you've done nothing wrong. Please let us help you. We will believe you. Please come back and let us learn. Let us learn.
It's interesting because some people took away the idea that it wasn't so much the perpetrator who was engaged in sinful behavior. I mean, definitely that,
yeah.
But that the victim themselves may have been involved in sinful behavior as well. And what you're saying is that that's kind of out of context and maybe not the description that Cook intended.
Well, no, he didn't intend that. But the problem was for so long, people, some bishops, not because the policy told them to, but because they did, had the victim try to repent. And so that's why people can read it that way. But I don't think that's what Cook intended.
Okay. Some tough messaging struggles for the LDS Church here, and they might... that whole story might take away from some other news that they'd have liked to have trumpeted more, the naming of two new apostles, for example. Dave Noyce, this is news that came out of the weekend's conference as well. Some new diversity, I guess, for church leadership, you might call it, for the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. Just before we move on to a break and other stories, tell us about that.
Historic change announced in the first 15 minutes of General Conference on Saturday morning. There were two openings within the Quorum of the 12 Apostles because of the death of Thomas S. Monson, the former church president, and Robert D. Hales, who died actually during the last conference, right in the middle of it. Two apostles were appointed, a Latin American, South American, mm-hmm. Ulysses Soares, and ahead of him, Garrett Gong, a Chinese Asian American. Definitely a recognition of the international church. As a matter of fact, that was probably one of the main things that came out of this general conference, was a recognition by top Mormon authorities and obviously the new president, Russell Nelson, that this is an international church and we need to start structuring the church internationally.
Michelle Quist, what does this mean for the church in general and, you know, in particular in terms of those optics to the rest of the world about what the church is?
I think members were really glad to see the choices, the inspired choices. You know, it does reflect a worldwide church, and it reflects that different perspectives are important and just as important.
Guys, we have to turn to our first break of the show and on to other stories. But David Noyce, thank you very much for covering these stories for us. When we come back, we'll turn to how Salt Lake City got left behind in the Inland Port deal. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and AARP Utah, a nonpartisan social change organization with a membership helping people 50 and over improve their lives by providing materials, programs, and advocacy on key issues. More information is available at aarp.org.
The ability of technology to manipulate and alter reality is growing at a breakneck speed.
Will technology blind us to the difference between what is real and what is fake news?
That's terrifying.
Is what I'm seeing true?
Oh, God.
Is what I'm hearing real? How do you have a democracy where people can't trust anything that they see or read?
Breaking news on the next Radio Lab.
Join us tomorrow at noon on Utah Public Radio.
President Trump promised to defend the country from all threats, foreign and domestic. We just never anticipated that the threat would be free two-day shipping. We'll ask Alexa, what's up with that? Plus, we'll talk to Ohio Governor John Kasich in Columbus about the days when politics were sane, mostly. Join us for this week's news quiz from NPR.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Bill Dentzer, managing editor David Noyce, environment reporter Emma Penrod, and columnist Michelle Quist. It's our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Bill Dentzer, government reporter, again, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
You wrote a really interesting account, a kind of postmortem, really, of how Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes, in his final legislative session, pushed through some legislation to help bring an inland port closer to fruition in Salt Lake City, in Salt Lake County, and is in Salt Lake City. In the process of that happening, it appears that Salt Lake City kind of got the short end of the stick. I'm not certain where to start here. Maybe let's get a reminder of what this whole inland port deal is about, Bill. Where is it supposed to go? What is it supposed to be?
That's a good way to start. Yeah, imagine a port facility like Oakland or Long Beach with hundreds of acres of machinery and equipment and infrastructure and businesses supporting it and jobs and people working there, dropping that in what is now the former landfill off of I-80 and covering that in a slab of cement and creating railroad tracks and all that. That's what an inland port looks like potentially here. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of it having it here, and everyone agrees that it's to the state's benefit, is the economic impact, the jobs impact. It would just transform that community, and which is now basically just, you know, barren mudflats.
And when you say everyone agrees, I mean, you're talking about stakeholders here. This is Salt Lake City, the state of Utah. The city had been eyeing this project from their own vantage point and with their own designs for a number of years, I think.
Right.
And but as I hinted in the first question, the city's aims and the state's aims didn't really line up, not in what came out of the legislative session. Can we talk about the basic framework of how this was addressed during the session? There was a bill by Jerry Stevenson. What was the intent of that bill?
Well, so actually, if we go back a year, Jerry Stevenson, the senator from Layton, floated a bill at the very end of the session, basically as a conversation starter on this whole topic. It wasn't going to go anywhere, really. But the idea of an inland port has been around for decades, and Salt Lake City has been working on its own master plan for that area of the city. It's called the Northwest Quadrant. They approved that plan end of last year and have made all kinds of agreements with property owners and all that. So there's the setup for how this starts this January. Now, in the beginning of January, the city's legislative lobbyists basically were going through their agenda, what they thought might come out of the legislature. They actually said, no, we don't expect anything on the Northwest Quadrant. Well, surprise, because at the end of January, we had a chance to meet and speak to Speaker Hughes. We had heard rumblings that this was coming up, and I asked him, I said, is this inland port bill coming up? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, later this week, there's going to be a stakeholders meeting. And that began as just kind of a small gathering, city and other stakeholders, but it became a very much of a public presentation, PowerPoint slides, the whole bit, on what a great idea this is. And by the way, the city's way too small to do it on its own, which was a shock to the city because the city, among other things, runs its own airport.
It's interesting. There's negotiating that happens then as a result during the legislative session, right? Where the city is saying, actually, we want to be included in this conversation. We have priorities. We've been working on this for a while. How far apart is what the city wants to do and what the state wants to do in terms of the actual nuts and bolts of this thing?
It really comes down to who runs the project. And the city, as part of that master plan, had been talking about doing it on its own. Maybe it was dragging its heels. Maybe it wasn't getting off the ground as quickly. But if you think about, as I said, all the economic impacts and all the flow through of what this can mean, you want to be in charge of that. You want to be setting the agenda and making the decisions about where things go. And so what emerged finally in the bill was a state authority with some representation from the city, but probably not enough for a facility that is almost entirely within Salt Lake City. And so and that authority not only has the right to make decisions, but it can overrule local zoning. The bill is written very strangely because at one point it says very clearly this authority will not do that, will not override local zoning decisions. But they have a whole section that creates an appeals board to do just that. So to go back to another example, let's say you're a homeowner and you want to build an addition on your house. And your homeowners association comes in and says, we're going to build it for you and we're going to run it for you. So how does that make you feel as a homeowner?
And that's who Salt Lake City is in this conversation. I'm curious about I know there are sticking points, including the land use authority, tax revenue. How is the tax revenue sort of allocated from this bill?
Well, that's kind of at the crux of the real issue here, is because that bill started out as having a fairly modest takeaway to fund itself using tax increment from the area under the special tax district that the city was creating. And what emerged in the last minute in the House version of that bill was something that took potentially up to 100% of all property taxes, city, county and school district. And the mandate for using that money was much broader. It went from just kind of running the agency to funding whatever the agency wanted to do there, this new agency they wanted to create.
Had Salt Lake City been in charge of this or you know, gone ahead with its vision, what kind of taxes would it have brought in for things like schools and, you know, mosquito abatement? And,
yeah, it's... Yeah. Well, it's not clear. I did not ever see a city plan that was that well, you know, formulated and drawn up. But what this really gets back to again is who runs this, who organizes this. And the city's point of view was, look, we don't need to write state law to do this. We can go forward with this inland port idea. We can do contractual agreements with the state and other stakeholders and keep it that way. That way we have more control over it. But some other additions to that bill, there's a specific provision that says you can't limit what kind of natural resources go through the port jurisdiction, which is actually a much larger area around what the facility would be. It's about 30 square miles or 34 square miles. Mm. And it now goes into West Valley City and Magna.
Can't limit. Go on. Continue on that.
Right. Well, so that gave rise to concerns that I mean, when you talk about natural resources, you talk about minerals, but you talk about things like coal and oil, too. So is the state hoping to kind of control coal going out of that port, and how would they do it?
Well, the state, you know, had designs on the Oakland export terminal that it was unable to secure because the city of Oakland essentially put a ban on coal. And this is in this bill, a prohibition on banning natural resources.
Moving through that area, right? Right.
It's interesting. How important was Speaker Hughes's role in getting this passed at the session?
Well, he really drove it as far as we could see. And it's interesting when you speak to the speaker, and we did a number of times about this. He speaks very much about, and so do all the proponents, that the cities can't. It's too big an operation for any one entity to do on its own, city, state, county. That's probably true. But again, we get back to who's setting this organizing authority up, and who's got the most membership on the board, and who's going to be ultimately driving its decisions. So, but it's interesting because I like to think of it. They used to say about Steve Jobs from Apple that he had something called a reality distortion field that he could create basically through his own vision, this kind of convincing argument for whatever he wanted and what other people around him wanted. And people said it kind of grudgingly, but they also said it admiringly. When you talk to the speaker about something like this, that's what you get. You really get a very compelling vision. But the arguments don't really hold because the city really is being rolled over by this. It is... it has to be said, it's a land grab and a power grab by the state.
Wow. Michelle Quist, what do you think of how all of this played out? I mean, I'm reading Bill's article and listening to him right now. Obviously, the city lost out. But it also sounds like this was a bit of an opaque process, that we didn't get full public weigh-in. This all happened in the last couple of days of the legislative session.
Yeah.
What's your take?
The transparency was certainly wanting. You know, I would love to see things get done as quickly as this appeared to get done. But we need a little more buy-in from stakeholders, from everyone that's involved. It's always ironic when a conservative government limits the power of cities underneath it, you know, because that's supposedly the framework under, you know, that they hold dear. And so Salt Lake City got rolled here.
Runs counter to the local control argument that is made. Go ahead, Michelle.
I don't think Mayor Biskupski helped herself. I mean, she wasn't in town on the last day. I don't know if that's true. Hmm. I know she went somewhere. But in general, her administration hasn't been working well with the conservative leaders in the legislature. Like, for instance, Ben McAdams, you know, his administration, he works really well with them, even though they're different political parties. That ends up hurting in the end.
Hmm. The governor signed this bill, the governor signed this bill, despite a concerted effort afterwards by Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski and others to lobby him to veto it, saying this was not in the best interest of, of the project, I guess. That didn't work. I mean, he did sign it.
Right.
What happens next? I mean, is there... how soon could an inland port become a reality out there?
I think the time frame is pretty long. There are going to be tweaks to this regardless of what happens in a special session that may or may not happen. I mean, there's really no kind of argument for the people who wanted this to go through this way to go back and change it in a special session just because the city and some other folks think it's better that way. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. But in terms of development, I mean, it's a big project. It's not going to happen overnight.
Right. There's obviously money at stake, even just in tax revenue and who gets to capture that tax revenue. Is there also a fear, I mean, just going to back to Michelle's point from you know, the state or from the legislature, at least, that Salt Lake City, which is an outlier in terms of its politics and general way of doing things in the state, that the state was worried about the city gaining more power because, again, a lot of money at stake. And besides the money that, you know, it wasn't agreeable from a political standpoint for state leaders to see Salt Lake City get that much power.
I think that's always kind of in the dynamic between the city and the state on any issue, and sometimes it's more pronounced. But we did hear that at the end. I mean, the city really wanted a certain way to go, and it was working with the Senate sponsor to get there. And it got to a point where it thought it could be palatable and manageable. But what came out in the House was much harsher to the city's interests. And as we heard, there were some House members who kind of wanted to reward, quote-unquote, the city for its obstinance in that whole process.
Hmm. Or punish, I guess, is the way to say it. Michelle Quist, I have the same question for you. There's an obvious, you know, divide. Salt Lake City is almost an alien island in the state of Utah in terms of its politics. How important was that in this discussion?
You know, I think with a project like the Inland Port, the political polarization was less important because of the scale of this project. Hmm. I mean, even if a Republican was mayor of Salt Lake City, the state would have wanted to get control of this.
Bill Dentzer, will there be any reconciling of visions here? I mean, you talked about a special session of the legislature, or is this just sort of the state's baby now? I mean, is there anything the city can do if there is a special session, or you know, future is there future sort of policymaking they can do?
That's a good question. The way most states are set up with localities, I mean, the states have all the cards, and localities are at a disadvantage. So there's nothing I don't want to say begging, but or suing, but it's hard to see what the city's options are here in terms of trying to get the state to give up a little bit and go back to something that was closer to Jerry Stevenson's original bill.
Was this always a foregone conclusion? I mean, has nobody ever stopped to say, hey, maybe this thing isn't such a great idea after all? A lot of growth, sure, but that brings with it its own set of problems. Has anyone been saying, let's pump the brakes here, Bill? I mean, now that the state has control of it, I can imagine the city saying that. But but is there, you know, anybody else who's been saying, hey, hang on a minute, the whole thing is we should call this into question?
Well, if you look at what's driving a lot of the conversation right now in the state, we've got a new prison going up in that area. We've got plans for Point of the Mountain, where the old prison was. We've got a lot of talk about development in the state, driving the economy. We also have a lot of talk about population and what that's going to do to the state in the coming decades. But really, I don't think – I have not heard anyone saying, hey, let's think about this and see if we really want to do this. Although certainly with that project come all kinds of environmental concerns and traffic concerns and overcrowding concerns. If people want to see huge trucks running down I-80, which is kind of what part of this looks like.
Hmm. Well, and it's not that far from the Great Salt Lake, which we will talk about a little bit later in the show as well with Emma Penrod. Dave Noyce, you're managing editor at the Tribune. You've been probably following this a little bit as well. How do you view this? I mean, I don't know what to ask you.
I had flashbacks to previous times where the state has sort of come down on Salt Lake City. In some respects, I think it almost doesn't matter what the state had come up with. Even if they'd come up with something the city really liked, they would still balk, and perhaps rightly so. I can remember instances where the state even dictated historic districts in the city about what could be a historic district and what could pass a moratorium, which is certainly just a city ordinance. I mean, it was another chance of the state saying, I think we run the show. You know, and the politics couldn't be more different between the city and the state. So I almost think it almost doesn't matter sometimes what the state had come up with.
Should other cities be concerned about the state, you know, coming in and saying, here's a chunk of land that we're gonna take, I mean, essentially take control of or take the benefits from? Or is this just a very specific instance?
Well, that was part of Salt Lake City's pushback on this, that if the state can do this here, it can do it anywhere. And Salt Lake City's right, but the state actually can do that. I mean, the state. It's exactly. And they, again, getting back to that homeowners association simplistic analogy, I mean, they make the rules. And so the question is, you know, getting back into the political dynamics, I mean, how do you want to play nice with going forward, and how do you want this to work without hard feelings? Hmm.
I think it could happen if another city as big as Salt Lake City suddenly becomes very liberal and blue. Otherwise, I'm not so sure if the other cities have to worry as much.
Huh. Right.
Okay.
Unless they have a $1 billion resource.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, Bill Dentzer dissected the inland port struggle at the legislature in a really interesting piece in this week's Tribune. Bill, thank you very much for talking to
us. Thanks for having me.
Give it a read, everybody. We're going to take another quick break here, but when we come back, since we've been talking about ports, we'll talk about water, which you normally need when you're talking about ports, but never mind. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
This week in This American Life.
Drive slow.
Yeah.
Before he leaves the Senate for good, Republican Senator Jeff Flake is trying to pass one last bill in a Senate that's dysfunctional, with a president who seems to hate his guts. Zoe Chase from our staff has followed him every step along the way during this process.
Why did you tell everyone you had a deal?
All I said is we pretty much have an agreement. I've gone rogue. This wasn't rogue.
Join us tomorrow morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. John Krasinski knows what you think when you look at him. He knows you might only see him as Jim from The Office, and he's grateful for that show, but he's also ready to show you how much more he can do with his brand new film. It's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Emma Penrod, David Noyce, Emma Penrod, Bill Dentzer, and Michelle Quist. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-8255. Offer your questions and comments for our panelists today, or post them at sltrib.com. To Emma Penrod, Tribune Environment Reporter now, the state of Utah, Emma, is seeking control over unclaimed water in Bear Lake, a sizable amount of it. They filed a request for water rights jointly with Idaho. Where did they file that request, and how much water are we talking about?
Yeah, so this request was filed with the Utah Division of Water Rights, which is where you file such a request, as well as jointly in Idaho with their counterpart there. It's kind of a two-state operation that's happening here. And they're seeking the right to use 400,000 acre-feet of water out of Bear Lake.
What does the state want with this water?
Good question. they have indicated that they want to store this water in Bear Lake and possibly at a future date use it in the event of a water shortage. And they say that could go to maybe farmers if the farmers needed the water because there was a drought, or it could go to cities, any number of cities, if they needed the water because there was a drought. But what the application specifically seeks is storage of the water and more or less, you know, ownership of the water, even though it's not technically ownership. It's a right to use the water.
Sure. I want to come back around to that, the right question for a moment. But there is the fact that the state is doing this is something that is concerning to environmentalists who are worried about another body of water altogether. You spoke with Linda Freitas with the group Friends of Great Salt Lake. She's got some concerns. Why?
Yeah, so this is water that right now is being released from Bear Lake for flood control purposes. That means that it's going to go downstream down the Bear River and ultimately end up in the Great Salt Lake. And so the concern, even though the state has said, well, maybe we could use this water if the Great Salt Lake levels got too low. It's, you know, a lot of options been thrown around. There is concern that if you're going to just keep this water in Bear Lake, that it will not get down to the Great Salt Lake and it will further cause the Great Salt Lake to dry up.
The Bear River being the major tributary for the Great Salt Lake.
At this point.
Yeah. Utah, for years now, has been pursuing a project to divert the Bear River to supply new development and growing communities. This new filing is for water above and beyond the water that the state already controls in the Bear River, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the lake feeds the river, so literally above and beyond. But also, we're talking about different water rights than those that the state would like to use for a Bear River diversion. Okay, so let's just dip into the downstream repercussions for a second. You reported that scientists estimate that the Great Salt Lake has shrunk considerably from its historic levels because of diversion of its historic tributaries like the Bear River. A host of concerns from environmentalists about what happens if the lake shrinks further, in addition to massive amounts of bird life that rely on the lake, and we're talking about millions of birds. There have also been concerns about a drying lake and what a dry lake bed means for human health here along the Wasatch Front. Can you talk about that, Emma?
Yeah. So, you know, there was a report that came out, or a study that came out, and this isn't the first study that came out and found this, but last year, where several scientists had gone and tried to calculate, you know, okay, how much water is going into the Great Salt Lake now? And how much water do we think used to go into the Great Salt Lake based on the fact that we've, you know, put dams and pipelines and every other manner of diversion on just about every river going into the lake? So what they concluded was that we have diverted away probably about half of the water that would naturally go into the lake, which led them to conclude that the lake is probably only half the size that it normally would be. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to determine exactly what the lake's, you know, quote-unquote natural level is, but that's what they found, is that we've taken probably about half of the water away from the lake. Mm-hmm. You know, the concern there being, you know, the lake's, the lake is an endpoint in the water system. The water, it goes into the lake, and then once it's there, it's going to stay there until it evaporates, or until someone takes it out, but we don't usually do that because it's salty. So because of that, its level naturally fluctuates quite a bit. Even within a year, it'll rise up in the spring, and then in the summer, as it evaporates, it goes back down. But they're saying that this should have been possibly a much bigger lake, those fluctuations notwithstanding, and its sensitivity to drought notwithstanding, because humans have taken so much water out of the systems that are upstream from the lake.
And then as the lake dries out, concern for air quality was one thing that I have seen over the years, that we might have dust storms. It's an endpoint, as you said. It's also near to, I mean, there's been historic mining. You have heavy metals. A question that I have, and this is from your article, is about whether or not this claim on water rights is a forerunner of the Bear River diversion. Are the two things connected? Can you draw a line between, you know, we want this 400,000 acre feet, and also that's part of the Bear River diversion desires of the state?
Well, the state denies that they're connected, and the state has already laid claim to more than 200,000 acre feet of water in the Bear River that is supposed to be tied to this Bear River development project that the state has authorized. The state has also indicated, as of last year, that they intend to put off that Bear River project because there isn't demand for the water from it. So I'm not really sure how close a line you can really draw to this request for an additional 400,000 acre feet to a project that, you know, the state already has the water for and has said we're not as interested in that as we used to be.
And you spoke with Eric Millis, who's the director of the Division of Water Resources. He says that's not what this is about. This is sort of provisional securing of water and figure out what to do with it later. I mean, is that...
That was what he indicated. He said, you know, as I understand it, the state of Idaho and Utah kind of got together. They were looking at this water, which they viewed as, you know, not being used and being unclaimed. And they thought, you know, we could come up with some better ways to control flooding on this water system. And if we did that, then maybe we could keep this water in the lake in case of something else.
Unused.
And they just thought, why would you not claim the water, I guess?
Was there a risk of losing? I mean, the claim, could some other entity have gone and claimed this 400,000 acre feet of water if Utah and Idaho had not done that?
That is always a risk. The way water rights work is if you want a water right and the water is unclaimed, it's not being used, you file with the state, you know, Division of Water Rights, and the state engineer takes a look at that and he says, yeah, no one's using this water. You have a good plan to use it. Here's your water right.
What is the use plan, though? I mean, we'd have this use it or lose it policy for water rights here in Utah and much of the West. You know, will the state, if this water claim is granted, will they have to do something with it to use it or lose it, that claim on 400,000 acre feet of water?
Use it or lose it is on the books. There's a lot of loopholes. A lot of people game that system. So, and it isn't clear at this point what the use plan is. As you stated, the state of Utah has kind of indicated that they were going to file this jointly with Idaho and then work out the details later, including the details of how are Utah and Idaho going to share this water.
Hmm. Michelle Quist, I don't know how to bring you in on this conversation. I mean, we're talking about prospective water right application for right. 400,000 acre feet. Has environmentalists concerned about downstream effects? You know, what do you see in this?
Well, you know, water obviously has been the linchpin in power and control for centuries throughout the world. So I understand the idea that the states, both Utah and Idaho, want to make sure that they can control it if they need to. Of course, the concern is always the Great Salt Lake and the level and the effect of reducing tributaries to that lake. Mm. That has to be clear before anything is granted, I would think. The effects on the Great Salt Lake.
Right.
You know, these plans are so uncertain as to what they want and what they want to do with it, and if they ever will do anything with it, that it just seems too unsure.
Hmm. You know, we're so low on time, and I wanted to squeeze in more coverage that you did this week, Emma. I think we're going to have to kind of leave it, but. What happens next here? Is there anything? We're just waiting to see whether or not that water right request is granted for the state of Utah and Idaho.
Yeah, and the state engineer will review that. Idaho will review that. And there is, several days, there is a period where people can file objections with the state engineer if they believe that they own this water right, if they believe their water rights could be negatively impacted by this request, or if they just don't think the request should be granted and have a reason for that, they can file a complaint about this request with the state engineer to try to get their side shown as well.
And there's a couple of day period for that. Is that now, or is that at a different time in the future?
It's right now, and it's about sometime around the 20th, kind of the middle of the month, I understand, that people have.
And I imagine that Linda Freitas from Friends of Great Salt Lake, you also spoke with Zach Frankel from Utah Rivers Council. These are two people who oppose the Bear River diversion. Are they going to oppose this in public commentary?
I guess we'll find out.
If
they
How
file.
Are you going to know? Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. Okay. Well, Emma, I really wanted to talk about another story you did having to do with a Tier 3 fuels refinery here in Salt Lake City. But I think that we're going to have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week and move to that afterwards. And that it's what we're doing now. Time for our final story, underplayed stories of the week. David Noyce, your pick.
I had three contenders, but I'm going to go with a story by Kathy Stevenson about Bangor Farms, which have a farm up in Davis County. They're sort of a staple of the farmer's market. If you go to a farmer's market, you'll see Bangor Farms there. And they had some acreage that they had to relocate because freeways were coming through, and that necessitated moving a city park, and now the city park needs to go where Bangor Farms is. And it's a really interesting story as Davis County increasingly becomes the land of roads.
Less and less rural and more developed, I guess, is the answer to that. Emma Penrod, your chance for an underplayed story of the week now.
Well, I guess we can cheat here. So Endeavor Refinery, this is formerly Tesoro, they broke ground earlier this week on a facility to produce a low sulfur tier 3 fuel. This fuel, it makes cars' emission systems run more efficiently so that it can remove more pollution from your emissions when you're driving. And it's expected to have a pretty significant impact on Utah's air quality if we get enough of this tier 3 fuel in the valley.
I'm going to just actually ask you a follow-up on that because we have a little bit of time to deal with it. Meanwhile, at the federal level, something is happening that might kind of undercut the positive gains that Utah could be making as a result of you know, something like this refinery. Can you just quickly dip into that story, Emma? What's happening at the federal level?
Well, there have been threatenings out of the EPA that they're going to be cutting some of these standards for fuel efficiency of vehicles, as well as possibly other vehicle emission standards. It's not entirely clear which standards will be affected and which standards will not be affected, but depending on what happens, that could also have a pretty significant impact on Utah's plans for cleaning up its air.
And that's something that Utah has been struggling to do. It has it's not meeting federal air quality standards in certain places, and this could conceivably inhibit that the attempt to try and do that.
Quite possibly.
Okay. Check out Emma's coverage on that, everybody. Michelle Quist, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
It's not necessarily underplayed, but it deserves more credit. This story about the teen suicides, the youth suicides in Harriman High, there have been five since mm-hmm. last summer. They're not yet calling it a cluster, but they're definitely looking at why. And the community's hurting and wants to fix it. Mm.
So. Interesting pick, and you can check it out at sltrip.com. Bill Dentzer, I didn't mention to you that we had an underplayed story of the week segment. I don't know if you even knew that, but do you have a story that you can highlight?
Well, what came to mind, maybe it's not underplayed, but Salt Lake City, I'll go back to my main beat, yeah. is contemplating a half penny increase in the sales tax. They might vote it on at the end of the month. They're also looking at maybe an $87 million bond. The response from residents has been one big yawn. It's interesting that there's some they have some ideas for how to spend this money, and they have very specific plans. But residents seem to say, "Okay, go ahead." It's interesting.
Huh. Meaning the fact that residents are just happy to see it happen without any sort of
polling is in favor of it, and the response at the public hearing on Tuesday night was kind of all over the place, but no one seemed to really object.
Interesting story. I'm going to go with a golf story. I know golf's not everyone's thing, but I grew up playing on municipal courses around town, and so did Tony Finau. And for a time yesterday, he was leading the Masters. So obviously, I'm next in line. Emma Penrod, David Noyce, Bill Dentzer, Michelle Quist, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of the show. Coming up next, we've got KCPW Presents. You can check it out here on KCPW on Utah Public Radio. They have another program. Check it out at upr.org. I want to thank Jesse Ellis, our operations and programming director here at KCPW. Up at Utah Public Radio, we've got Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey. Thanks to you. And many thanks, as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Arts reporting on Utah Public Radio is supported by the Office of the Executive Vice President and Provost, celebrating USU's Year of the Arts.
The internet can be a great place for a lot of people, but not everyone.
It basically immediately went straight to the rape and death threats, like that same night, and continued unabated for weeks and months and now years.
Why is the internet such a toxic place for women? That's next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Join us Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. John Krasinski knows what you think when you look at him. He knows you might only see him as Jim from The Office, and he's grateful for that show, but he's also ready to show you how much more he can do with his brand new film. It's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.